Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Iowa. I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Professor of Philosophy at Vanderbilt University. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books, drawing from a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Menachem Fish, Professor of History and Philosophy of Science at Tel Aviv University. His new book, Creatively Undecided, Toward a History and Philosophy of Scientific Agency, is just out from University of Chicago Press. Thomas Kuhn upset both scientists and philosophers of science when he argued that transitions from one scientific framework or paradigm, as he put it, to another were irrational. This change was like a religious conversion experience rather than a reason shift from one theory to another based on the best evidence. But even if one disagrees with Kuhn, how can this change be shown to be rational? More generally, how can transitions from one set of normative standards to another be rational, given that there is no neutral position from which one can criticize one's own normative standards? Fish takes up this challenge. He defends an account of framework change which accepts that we cannot be self-critical of our own standards, but we can be destabilized by external criticism. Some of those who are ambivalated in this way then creatively attempt to tackle their ambivalence by developing hybrid theories, which in turn provide others in the scientific community with a means to critically assess their theories and develop new frameworks. Fish's book draws on work from Korsgaard, Friedman, Galison, McDowell, and others in a rich discussion of the dynamics of normativity in science, and he uses debates on the foundations of algebra in the 1830s to illustrate his account. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Menachem Fish. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Hi, Carrie. Pleasure.
So your book is a very interesting look at a question that arose earlier on in the philosophy of science, basically from Thomas Kuhn's book on scientific revolutions, and his whole idea that you have paradigms, and the issue of paradigm change was, you know, famously or infamously on his view, a question of basically a religious conversion from one paradigm to the next. And there are a lot of reasons for this, but it was basically the irrationality of the change that got a lot of scientists, a lot of philosophers very upset. And so this is a very interesting look at that issue of how scientists sort of come from one theoretical framework to another theoretical framework, and a defense of a particular way in which that can be understood as a rational process. So it's an interesting look at something that hasn't been a hot topic for a number of years, and so it's quite exciting to be able to revisit that and think about it from a completely different perspective. But before we get to the book, maybe you can start us off with a little bit of biography about yourself. How you came to philosophy and how you came to be interested in this particular topic and to the writing of the book.
Well, thank you, first of all, for framing the book's project so well. How I came to it's a long story, but I'll cut to the chase. I started off studying physics and math, and growing more and more claustrophobic in the sense that, in the move from one's first degree to graduate work, you sort of narrow down considerably. And I found myself being interested and drawn by the broader and larger questions. It took me a while to realize that those questions were not larger scientific questions, but rather questions about science. So I switched after a period of time outside the university. I went back to study philosophy, and sort of capitalizing on whatever mathematical knowledge and skills I had, I was drawn initially to sort of more technical work in inductive logic, confirmation theory, philosophy of science. I mean, the hot potato, as you put it in those days, was Les Kuhn. The hot potato were the Raven's paradoxes, the paradoxes of confirmation. And I wrote about that and found myself more and more committed to a Popperian frame of mind. And a Popperian by Popperian frame of mind, I meant essentially the sort of master idea of Popper's philosophy. And that is that rationality, to act rationally, to conduct oneself rationally, is to take a critical view of things. And that identification of rationality and criticism is something that's still very, very much with me as a sort of basic philosophical commitment. However, what I began to realize is that to take a critical look and to view rational action in science and outside science as action taken for a reason, and action taken for a reason being taking stock of one's situation, one's knowledge, oneself, and finding something wanting or lacking sufficiently to justify intervention. Now, it took me a while to realize that vocabulary of wanting, being problematic, lacking, is a normative vocabulary. And people committed to different normative frameworks will judge the same situation differently. And they will see problems where other people do not see problems, and not see problems where other people do. In other words, and you can actually hear Popper turning in his grave, perhaps, the very notion of the very adoption of a Popperian point of view in that respect, it renders rationality and criticism framework dependent inherently by necessity. In other words, to take a critical stance, one has to be committed to a normative framework, a framework of standards of propriety by which one judges things to be inappropriate enough, wrong enough, lacking enough to justify intervening. This is true of science, it's true of politics, it's true of ethics, true of religion, true actually of all rational endeavor. Okay? Now, this is the sort of first this is my point of departure in this book, because if you accept, and this will sound kind of weird to people who were brought up like I was, believing that Popper and Kuhn posed diametrically opposed philosophies of science, to say that to adopt a Popperian position, one has to, by necessity, adopt a Kuhnian view of the framework dependency of all rational endeavor is something that's never really been put like this before, as far as I know. Now, the second problem is the problem that you alluded to when attributing rightly a notion of conversion, and the other notion Kuhn uses is a gestalt switch when it comes to paradigm shifts, to transitions of normative frameworks. Kuhn was incapable of giving an account of the rationality of changing one's standards of rational endeavor. He never put it this way, but it's obviously the problem lurking in the background that one cannot deem inappropriate one's standards of propriety. Okay.
Can I
Can I interject for a second there? Because we're sort of gotten, deeply into the book already. So there was a question that I had when you're talking about the Popperian versus Kuhnian normative framework. So it sounds like you are simply identifying having standards of propriety with a framework. In other words, the standards are the framework. Is that correct? Because it seems to me that framework for Kuhn was, he uses the word paradigm and you don't, but it's the same. For him, that the framework would certainly not be identical to the standards.
Kuhn didn't give a very good account, a philosophical account, of what he meant by frameworks. But he said quite a bit by associating a paradigm with the kinds of norms of conduct, of science. Specificity, if I could use the word, of what a fact is, what an explanation is, what's the proper procedure, what goes without saying and what doesn't, and so on and so forth, which is the sort of process of culturation that a graduate student undergoes when becoming a scientist. You adopt a language, a way of thinking, and a set of standards by which to operate, and by which you'll be judged, and by which you'll be making judgments in your work. Now, this is what brings Kuhnian paradigms in line with normative frameworks in general. And my work, I think, is my work, in a sense, is more general than science, but where in the discussion of normativity, and we'll get to that, I assume, a little later on, but people who have dealt with normativity, like John McDowell, like Robert Brandom, like Christine Korsgaard and others, Wittgenstein, the later Wittgenstein is probably the best example. He wrote more than anyone about forms of life and language games, but does not talk at all about the dynamics by which forms of life change and shift, and the way in which language games undergo transitions, and cultures and communities sort of change from one language game to another, or one form of life to another. Now, in general philosophy of mind and world and language, normativity and self, the vast majority of the community sort of managed to get away without talking about the dynamics of normativity. But in science, you can't do that since Kuhn, because it's obviously the case that to take account of science is not only to take account of the way science normally conducts itself within the framework of a given paradigm and a given set of scientific norms, but you also need to account for paradigm shifts, which indeed happen. Popper himself poo-pooed that, and this is really what got me started. The very last essay Popper wrote and published gave the title to that collection of essays. I think it was published in 1994. It was called The Myth of the Framework. Now, that really rubbed me the wrong way, or really got me thinking, because as I said before, there's no way in the world to be able to talk about criticism without a normative framework. Finding something wrong, criticizing a situation, is framework dependent in precisely the sense I outlined before. So the problem then becomes the following. So you can articulate a Popperian point of view, which is framework dependent, but the question that Kuhn left open was, how can you account for the rationality of framework transitions or paradigm shifts? Because it's by means of the old paradigm that you're ruling things right or wrong. So how can you find that ruler itself, that set of norms, sufficiently wrong to require replacement? This is a question that hasn't really been asked. I mean, the person who confronted it in the most detail, in a profoundly more philosophical way than Kuhn ever did, was Michael Friedman. But Michael Friedman sort of narrows down that question to a question of choice: how do practitioners committed to the old paradigm justify moving to a new paradigm? But the real question for understanding science is not a question of choice between given paradigms, new and old, but how to explain how a practitioner can find the paradigm constitutive of his work sufficiently lacking to want to devise a new one. Okay, not to join the opposition. There is no opposition, but those creative moments in the life of a science where someone finds sufficient justification to grope towards new opportunities in this respect, and this is this is really what I wanted to do in the book. So I mean, the short answer to your initial question was that I sort of came of philosophical age within the Popperian camp, realizing the normative constraints on normativity itself, finding an account of that framework dependency in the neo-Kantianism of Kuhn and people like Kuhn. I say neo-Kantianism because Kuhn himself described himself later in life as operating, as offering a Kantian picture with movable categories rather than fixed categories. So how can you maintain a Popperian notion of rationality within this neo-Kantian view of the framework dependency of scientific work? And this is the question that animates this book and the type of answer I try to develop in it.
So we're talking about these transitions, these as you put it very nicely, the dynamics of normativity, of how individuals can, may be able to shift, how to explain the rationality of that. And you describe it in various ways in terms of destabilization or ambivalating, becoming ambivalent. And the important, I think, insight or one of the insights here is the idea that as you just sort of hinted, if framework dependence is true and one's very standards of assessment of normative assessment or criticism, if those are framework dependent, then it's very difficult to see how you might criticize them, because that just seems to be a sort of a contradiction. And you say, well, even though that might be true, it doesn't follow that there can't be contradiction, period. The contradiction instead, or that there can't be criticism, sorry, period. The criticism comes from the outside. It comes from, as you put it, trusted external sources. And this is what destabilizes or creates an ambivalence. And that enables some sort of dynamic change of frameworks to occur in a rational sense. It's not merely destabilizing. It's destabilizing in a way that allows for a rational change. So let me just to sort of put that whole thing into the framework of the book. You have one part of the book, is describing that whole process, and that you kind of break down into three different themes of what you kind of just introduced a bit. The idea of framework dependence was one idea. Another is this idea of what you call critical rationalism, And then there's a third theme, which you kind of call, which you call sort of Hegelian. So each of those three themes kind of work together to bring together the whole sort of philosophical framework for this dynamical view of normativity. And then in the second part, you try to illustrate how this happens with an actual case from actually the history of mathematics and debates about the foundations of algebra in Cambridge in the 1930s. And you focus on a particular figure, Peacock, and some of his colleagues there at Cambridge, you know, Babbage and Herschel and so forth. Okay, so there's two broad sections to the book. One is the philosophical framework, another is the application to a particular case. So maybe, you know, maybe we can start by talking about what's the basic, you know, just the very basic moves that you make in the framework and before we get to the case itself.
Yeah. Well, let me say first what I want to emphasize so that people don't get the wrong idea. This isn't a theory of how normative commitment changes. I mean, our normative commitments change surreptitiously all the time. You did put it carefully at the beginning. This is a book about how normative transitions that are rational are possible. I mean, in aesthetic taste, for example, I mean, we find ourselves awakening to the fact that we've lost interest in certain genres of music and literature. We find we dress differently. That when looking in the mirror and getting ready for a very posh occasion, we judge ourselves to be appropriately dressed very, very differently than we did as the snapshots in our album indicate 10 or 15 years ago. And there was no moment in which we deemed those ways wrong and this way is right. We say it's like falling in or out of love, caring less and caring more, and normative commitment sort of shifts surreptitiously over time. What we would not like to think is that in science, in religion, in ethics, in politics, such changes are merely surreptitious, or merely because we've become tired of one, and we're becoming excited about the other. We'd like to think that such shifts in ethics, in science, in politics, are rational, and performed for a reason. Now, As you've already said, it seems to be obvious that if you take the notion of framework dependency in a strong neo-Kantian firm sense, as I do, and you deem a rational move to be acting in the light of criticism, then we're up against a wall. We're in a dead alley, it seems, and this problem borders on the incoherent. It's unsurmountable. There is no way in the world, it seems, in which we can create sort of critical distance, critical self-distance from our own standards by which we make those moves. The premise of the book is that there's nothing wrong with that argument, that left to our own devices, talking to ourselves, or rather, if we insist that the drama of deliberation remains intrasubjective, you know, within the confines of talking to ourselves, as in Kant's Second Critique, for example, then there's no way in the world in which we can create that distance. When Kant talks about ethics, he's therefore forced to say that morality is absolute, it's universal, And you know, just like his categories and forms of intuition in the first critique, it's a question of becoming aware of what is universally hardwired, basically, into our way of thinking. But since Kant, we've realized that the synthetic a priori in science changes, our standards change, paradigms shift, and therefore we have to give an account of how they do and if they can shift rationally. Kuhn, I think, believed that they couldn't. And Michael Friedman tries to soften paradigm shifts, to view them as less radical than they really are, and ends up not being able, in my opinion, as I explain in the book, to solve the problem. I think, and this brings me to the third point, which you alluded to, and that is the Hegelian, in inverted commas, the Hegelian added element to the two first Kantian ones, or neo-Hegelian rather, and that is the realization, and I think everyone can attest to this, that when exposed to the echo chamber of the critique, of the normative critique of other people who think differently from us, we are sometimes rendered ambivalent to the norms that they question in ways in which we cannot ambivalent ourselves, precisely because we can't create that distance. There's a metaphor or an analogy I draw on in the book, and that is of a recording device. And everyone's experienced this, the way in which listening to a recording of your voice, I'm recording my voice now and I'll be listening to it later on, or watching yourself on closed circuit TV, can often be very, very disturbing. There's often a real discrepancy between the way you realize people hear or see you and your own self-image from within. And that sort of critical distance cannot be achieved merely by talking to ourselves. You need that device. And I explained at length in the book, I don't know if we want to get into that now, but there's something about the way the normative criticism is leveled against us that sort of confronts us with a normative portrayal of ourselves by those who criticize us that jars with our own normative portrayal. And it's that discrepancy of pictures, of normative portrayals, that is capable of destabilizing our commitment to the norms in question. And once they are destabilized sufficiently and we're rendered ambivalent towards them in a sort of Harry Frankfurt sense of the term, then with the rest of our commitments that remain firm, we are able to take a critical view of those demoted norms. Very, very often we'll be defensive and reinsert them as before and keep on going. But occasionally, that's how and where a framework transition will begin. So that's the sort of general philosophical idea. But what this book tries to do is to translate that into a model of a model for scientific paradigm shifts. And the case of science sort of presents us with a special kind of situation, because if we now agree that the only way in which a paradigm can be assessed critically is by exposure to external critics, where does a scientific community encounter its external critics? It's not merely a sociological question. I mean, the truth of the matter, as I put it in the book, is that only physics can change physics. Only chemists can change chemistry. Only biologists can change biology. So the only way in which to begin to account for setting a paradigm shift in motion is to envisage a practitioner of sufficient voice and standing traveling outside the community, becoming ambivalated elsewhere by external critics, and then returning to the community and sort of ambivalating it. And this is these two stages delineate the basic components of the narratology of scientific framework transitions that the book attempts to articulate, and then test with the case study I give at the end.
Well, let me just ask about this external, internal, you know, physics can only physicists can change physics, and chemists can change chemistry, and yet there has to be, could you articulate that a bit more? Because clearly, if the account depends on external criticism in order to ambivalate a field or a bunch of practitioners in it, then it has to be kind of clear what it is for something to count as being external to whatever. And I would say, you know, from one perspective, chemists are not external to chemistry. So I'm not clear on how it can be true that you have external criticism of chemistry, yet only chemists can change chemistry. So there's that first thing. And then there's this issue, which I don't recall that you talk about much in the book, but it's the idea also that it's trusted external criticism, or and that there are particular individuals in a scientific community that are somehow more open to the external criticism, or in some sense more affected by it, or something like that, and that these particular people force both sociological as well as presumably individual psychological factors are able to actually assume this role of the leader. So could you say a bit more about how it is that you have...
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Sure. Let's start with Popper. I mean, one of Popper's great ideas is that criticism should not be viewed as an attack. Criticism should not be viewed as a negative view. Criticism should be viewed as a friendly engagement, precisely. From the point of view of my book, is what an external critic can give you, which you can never give yourself, is a different perspective, and articulate criticism from the point of view, and do so honestly and with conviction from the point of view of his or her other framework, in ways that you cannot offer yourself. Now. The way in which I envisage being ambivalated from the outside is by means of an idea which was initially promoted very, very interestingly by Peter Galison, the notion of a scientific trading zone. Theoretical physicists need mathematicians. Experimental physicists need to talk to instrument makers. They need to talk to computer people, and so on and so forth. And just like the sociological, anthropological notion of a trading zone in which two cultures meet and develop a sort of pidgin language, simplified mediating language by which they can trade without having to bring, you know, their entire metaphysics and set of beliefs into a safe trading zone, where where they can do business without being exposed, it is an idea that Peter adopted to account for the way in which sort of scientific knowledge travels across disciplinary borders. When physicists talk to mathematicians, when practitioners talk to students, and so on and so forth. Now, what for Peter Galison, very much with the idea of a pidgin language and a Creole in mind, thought about the trading zone only in terms of simplification, which of course, if you read a calculus textbook for physics, it doesn't get into the nitty-gritty of the mathematical foundations that the very same calculus will be taught within the mathematical community. That goes without saying. But what the added insight I gave to the in the book to the trading zone is the following. When you're talking, let me give you a sort of a biographical example. I was lucky enough to spend a year at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. And I was there. I was a philosopher, historian of science. I was a member of the School of Historical Studies. But I took quite a bit of interest in what was going on in the School of the Natural Sciences, and especially the group working on string theory there. And I'd corner someone, I did this two or three times with professors from the school, and I was really, really curious, not critical, really, really curious to understand their work and what they're doing and the way in which string theory would sort of unify relativity, gravity theory, and quantum mechanics. Now, the difference between having a conversation on string theory at their table with their colleagues and having that conversation with me is that with me, of course, he'd make it simple. But on the other hand, he'd have to say more because there is far less he could take for granted when talking to me. He'd have to articulate basics, which we don't do in our home community where we're in agreement about the basics. This is something one experiences when traveling abroad. You need what's taken for granted at home very often needs to be articulated, and you're faced with inoffensive questions of clarification, requests for articulation, and you find yourself talking aloud, sometimes for the first time, about lots of stuff that you absolutely took for granted. Now, we've all experienced this when talking abroad, that suddenly our voice sounds hollow, and suddenly we're fielding questions, innocent questions, friendly questions, non-threatening questions, but questions that are never raised in our home community. Now, very often, we're very confident and we give the answers and we go back home unruffled. But in these situations, we may very well become ambivalated. I use ambivalence in a verb form in the book. We can become ambivalated. We can, find ourselves returning home slightly cross-eyed. With wrinkles in our forehead, not quite sure what's going on, and worrying that something might be amiss, although we can't put our fingers on it. Now, if ambivalence very often it will remain, there was a book once written about German physicists at the turn of the century, sort of caught between classical physics and the new relativity theory and quantum mechanics. It was called Night Thoughts of a German Physicist. And very often these worries, this ambivalence, this sudden lack of certainty, this the destabilization of what we thought was absolutely certain and we were committed to remains in the confines of the night thought, of the confines, among the Victorians I worked on, of the diary, or maybe the private communication. That kind of worry, that kind of ambivalence, that kind of lack of sureness and uncertainty doesn't travel very far. But often, what will happen if we're talking about a sufficiently creative individual, and the book is called Creatively Undecided, a Galileo, a Poincaré, a Tycho Brahe, a George Peacock, a William Whewell, a William Rowan Hamilton. What will happen is that this person will creatively attempt to tackle this ambivalence by producing a confident picture of the foundations of the science, which will be hybridic. It'll be hybrid. I mean, if you think of Galileo's worldview, it's half Greek and half not Greek anymore. If you think of Tycho Brahe's sort of impossible mixture of geocentric and heliocentric cosmology, Poincaré remaining committed to a Kantian notion of form of intuition, but rendered a convention rather than hardwired. And my own Peacock, in the example we may talk about more in a minute, fashioning a theory of algebra, which is at the very same time both a theory of number and a totally formal symbolical system. Now these hybrids, the sort of foundational split pictures, are sort of presented by these people as answers to their problem. But what they really do is to articulate the problem in a dramatic form, in a way that is capable of ambivalating others and forcing others to run with some of the balls and setting that framework transition in motion. In other words, the claim of the book basically is, or the double claim of the book basically, in terms of the narratology, of accounting for how rational framework transitions happen in science, is to account, A, for the way in which a creative individual was initially ambivalated outside the community in conversation with people who did not share his framework or her framework, and then coming back to the community and creating a stir by producing an intermediary work, creative, ingenious, but neither here nor there, hanging on to the old, groping towards a new possibility, which is sort of internally jarring sufficiently not to allow people to settle for it. And in that way, ambivalating other practitioners and setting this in motion. So the key figure in a framework transition then becomes those intermediary, in retrospect, confused, perhaps unclear, not totally coherent thinkers, who then vanish from the record after creating a havoc. And the book is really a plea to center stage, to foreground these hybridic works and these intermediary figures, because they are the key to setting a framework transition. And then the person who comes later with a bright idea and polishes off the new framework is really reacting to them rather than creating and seeing through the framework transition alone. So it's a narratology not of scientific heroes, but of creative indecision, which is the title I chose for the book.
there seem to be two different levels of framework transition. One is at the individual level, and another is at the, you know, the group level. It's just to put it that way. And it seems like, and I'm just wondering, are you giving like one account for these two different levels? Because in some cases, it seems like there's an individual who experiences self-criticism, and maybe they will end up in a hybrid position, and then they translate that, and they're sort of a transitional figure who then helps bring the field into a new space by providing this kind of hybrid, you know, bridge of some sort. But then, of course, there are other individuals who come up with, you know, sort of new frameworks. I'm not sure how exactly that's supposed to happen, where there doesn't seem to be, maybe there's no transition, or I'm not exactly sure, but you get people like in your example, like Babbage, who just come up with a new framework. And I'm just wondering, the account you give on the one hand seems to be directed at both individual transitions in their normative commitments and group level normative commitments. So are you giving the same account for both?
Well, in a sense, yes. But I need to explain that, because the book, and I say something to this effect towards the end, there's an element, there's a subtext to the book which constitutes, I think, something of an act of protest. The way in which the problem of accounting for the rationality of framework, of scientific framework, sort of stumped Kuhn and stumped the community, created or developed or signaled a parting of ways. Philosophers of science, and I'm not now counting Michael Friedman. Michael Friedman in 2000 wrote Dynamics of Reason, and he was really the first person to try and take the bull by the horns. But up until then, philosophy of science was worried about Bayesian confirmation theories and technicalities like that, and didn't really rise to the occasion. Didn't enter conversation as the way I try to do in the book with philosophers working on normativity in general. Again, like Christine Korsgaard working in metaethics, questions of mind and world, like in John McDowell's famous book, questions of the normativity of language and conceptualization, as in Brandom. And so on and so forth. What I believe is that philosophy of science has sort of lost contact with these very, very important, with this very, very important work, writ large in general, in the neo-Kantian sort of tradition in metaethics, philosophy of language, philosophy of self, philosophy of normativity, and there was much to learn from them. And at the same time, I think they had much to learn about, you know, the special problem of normativity as it poses itself within science. So the book attempts, on the one hand, to bring philosophy of science back into the more general philosophical fold. The other sort of active process was that one of the effects of the sort of Kuhnian impasse regarding the rationality of framework transitions was a sort of, let me call it, a retreat to collectivity. It became increasingly difficult to give an account of the way an individual changes his or her mind in the way I try to account for, and the way that changing of mind can change other people's mind. And that difficulty sort of played out in the historiography of science that developed after Kuhn, which became a historiography of scientific collectives. Lots of work about scientific traditions and scientific skills and scientific practices and communities and schools and so on and so forth. And much less about the rationality of an individual deliberation, the way in which argument and dialogue can have a transformative effect on the way people think. And therefore, the book is the main title is Creatively Undecided. The subtitle is Towards a History and Philosophy of Scientific Agency. And what I wanted to bring back into the discussion is not merely a broader philosophical perspective, but the very notion of scientific agency. Now, I'm not a sociologist and I'm not a social historian, and there are people out there who could set, and this is my great hope, is that people who would set the sort of narratology of agency which I give within a broader sociological, a communal, collectivist setting, which you know I'm not too good at. The book is ambitious, but it's modest on two counts. The first count I spoke of before. It's not about a normative change in general, but about the rationality of normative change. And it's modest in the second that it's not trying to give a complete picture of the way a community changes its mind. But it does give an account, or purports to give an account, of the way individuals do, and the way, and by means of that case study, the way in which an individual of voice and standing, like Peacock, causes perhaps the greatest mathematician of the first two thirds of the 19th century, certainly working within the English-speaking world, William Brown Hamilton, still a very young man. In 1830, when Peacock's book came out, he was doing absolutely crystal work in optics and in analytical mechanics. I mean, his work on the Hamiltonian in theoretical mechanics was very much underway. And reading Peacock's book on algebra, Hamilton basically stopped in his tracks. He left optics forever, he left mechanics forever, and devoted the next 15 years to devising an algebra he called quaternions, which would be realistic, envisages algebra as the science of pure time in the Kantian sense of the term, but not the sort of ordinal, one-dimensional vision of time, but by means of quaternions, of triplets of numbers, eventually building the basis for vector analysis and the tensor calculus. But this is the way in which the Peacock's totally hybridic work sort of manages to ambivalate Hamilton sufficiently to leave everything and to devise this new framework for mathematics, which he thought was realistic, but ended up he himself viewing it a la Peacock as a formal and symbolical system. The same goes for Augustus De Morgan, and the same goes for D.F. Gregory, who didn't live long enough to carry it through. So the impact of Peacock's hybridic, impossible, ambivalent algebra on these leading lights of the community is the way to understand how the understanding of mathematics sort of broadly changed at the communal level as a result of that. But what I deal with in the book are individuals talking to individuals. Absolutely.
Well, we're getting close to running out of time, so I don't think we'll I'll have to leave to the listeners actually looking at the very interesting discussion of Peacock's treatise on algebra and this the juxtaposition of a arithmetical generalization, algebra is a generalization of math. Right, as opposed to a purely formal, the one that I believe Babbage had thought of. But one of the you give a nice, clear sort of run through of how Peacock illustrates the general ambivalating of the individual, who then has this effect on the rest of his community. One of the questions I had. Was Kuhn was his main examples obviously were from the history of physics, Newton to Einstein, and those sorts of cases were his paradigms of paradigm shifts. And so one of the questions that came up for me was the fact that if you're talking about mathematics. I mean, to put it another way, with Kuhn, a lot of the blowback that he faced was precisely the idea that science was supposed to be rational in this sense of, well, we decide our theories, we make theory choices on the basis of the empirical evidence. And there was space for other things, and he kind of backtracked in certain ways. But I mean, that was the basic problem that people had with Kuhn, was that he made science look irrational in the sense that here they are doing all these experiments, and then ultimately the theory choice is just this religious conversion. I mean, that was what was so upsetting to so many people. So I'm just wondering how this, how the question of empirical evidence and that, the weight of empirical evidence on the changes of frameworks, how does that fit in? It doesn't come in the case of mathematics so much, but it certainly does come in for physics or chemistry or biology. And so how does the empirical evidence kind of figure into your overall picture?
First of all, the sort of naive idea, the non-philosophical idea, let me say, that the world talks back, is very, very problematic. Wilfred Sellers, one of my heroes and one of the heroes of the people the book is in discourse with, dubbed the idea that, of course, there's a world out there. Of course, we believe in an external reality. Not only is there a world out there, but it impacts on our nerve ends and has a causal effect on us. But those irritations of our nerve ends, optical and so on and so forth, do not carry conceptual content. The content is imparted on those neural irritations by the mind, by means of the language we speak, by means of the concepts at our disposal. The person who wrote most clearly about this is John McDowell in Mind and World. Our theories, our conceptual schemes do not spin in a void. Okay, they rub up against the world, but they do not rub up against the world in the sense in which the world speaks back in the language we speak. It's a very, very subtle and, again, framework dependent in the deepest, profoundest sense of the term, enterprise. So what we see and what we experience and the ways in which we conceptualize this is very much in a Kantian, neo-Kantian spirit, conceptualized by the mind. The meeting of the mind and world is precisely that. So therefore, when a paradigm shift happens, I mean, Kuhn himself says, he described it this way, and I describe it the same. I'm an absolute realist about external reality, but that realism is framework dependent. And when a paradigm shifts, Kuhn put it very, very bluntly, we find ourselves in a new world. Standards of facticity, how things appear to us, what they represent, what their significance are framework dependent. Now, what I didn't want to get into was into the fray of that set of disagreements. Empiricism and the Philosophy of Mind is the name of Wilfred Sellers' famous essay, where that notion of the myth of the given, as though there's a bedrock of given experience to which sits, as Quine put it in one place, as the tribunal of our theorizing, is incoherently misguided. And so therefore mathematics allowed me, treating mathematics as a sort of a case study of the way in which a normative framework changes, allowed me to get away from this sort of very, very heady discussion of empiricism and reality and realism and the framework dependency and the language dependency of that, to normative frameworks almost stand in isolation from the real world, where mathematical realism is not about fitting the facts, but about being about things like time or number, and so on and so forth. So I thought that would be a good example. I've done work on William Whewell, who worked on mathematical physics, but I didn't want to rehash that as an example. I preferred Peacock because it would give me a sort of a clean account of framework shifting without raising the problem of empiricism. But I think I state clearly at the beginning that I'm not defending that position in the book, but I belong within the neo-Kantian, Brandomian, McDowellian camp that takes Sellers' view of empiricism.
Okay, very good. Well, I think we're out of time at this point. There's a lot more, many more questions, but I think we should probably end and just invite readers to look at the book themselves. But for now, I think we should end. And I wish to thank you again for speaking with New Books in Philosophy.
Thank you so much, Carrie. This has been wonderful. Thank you.
Okay, goodbye.
Goodbye.
You've been listening to my interview with Menachem Fish, who is professor of history and philosophy of science at Tel Aviv University. We've been talking about his new book, Creatively Undecided, Toward a History and Philosophy of Scientific Agency, which is just out from University of Chicago Press. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. And I hope you enjoyed the podcast. And thank you again for listening. Bye-bye.